supposed to play here in Chicago next month.
I don't know anything about it.
Grace shrugs her right shoulder.
Why are you still keeping track of where he's going to be? You need to get your own life, Mom.
Karina feels her cheeks flush. Grace's quick comment is too sharp, an insulting slap, and it feels cruel, especially in front of Matt, someone who doesn't know Karina's complicated history. But she believes Grace's insensitivity was unintentional and swallows the urge to defend herself. She and Grace have had many heart-to-hearts about this over the past year. Now that Grace is in college, Karina could move. She could live in New York or New Orleans or Paris. She could give up teaching and play again. She could reinvent her life, or at least track down the one she abandoned. She could do anything, or at least something.
Where's your musical talent? Matt asks Grace.
I'm like the best karaoke singer ever.
The best worst? You sure you weren't adopted?
I look just like her.
Or maybe you were dropped on your head?
That would explain my taste in men. This time Matt shoves Grace's arm and Grace giggles. Men, not boys. When did her little girl become a young woman? It occurs to her that Grace is the same age Karina was when she met Richard. They were in Sherman Leeper's technique class together. She knew nothing about Richard except that he seemed awkward and intensely driven. She could feel him staring at her in class, too shy to talk, for almost an entire semester. Then one day, he did. They were at a keg party at one of the dorms. Emboldened by beer, he introduced himself. One beer turned into many, catalyzing their attraction, but not until she heard him play piano did she fall for him. They were alone in a practice room, and he played Schumann's Fantasy in C major, opus 17. He was so connected to the piece that he seemed to become unconscious of her presence. His playing was powerful yet gentle, assured, masterful. And the composition is so utterly romantic, still one of her favorites. By the time he played the final note, she was in love. They had sex morning and night, more often than she brushed her teeth. She spent her days memorizing Bach and Mozart, and her nights memorizing the shape of him, the first and last notes of every day played on each other's body. They were passionate, insatiable for piano and each other. Nothing else existed. She'd never been happier. She knows this is her history, the early chapters in the biography of her life. Yet she feels utterly disconnected from it. She remembers that first year with Richard. Yet these memories, these snapshots of body parts tangled up in bedsheets, feel as if they must belong to someone else. A character in a book she read long ago. The thought of Richard even kissing her now is revolting. That she ever desired him, crazy. That they were married, surreal. Yet it all happened. She watches Grace listening to Matt, smiling, flirting, enamored, and wonders what their narrative will be. She hopes her daughter fares better in love and marriage than she did. Don't repeat the mistakes I made. Could Karina have seen the red flags through the thick haze of lust at 20? Was there any way to predict all that would unfold? Possibly. Richard was always a bit of a narcissist, a fragile egomaniac, a selfish prick. She naively thought that these were the character traits of any talented, ambitious man. The price of admission. She respected his dedication to piano and admired his confidence. Looking back, she can see that his dedication was desperation, his confidence was arrogance, that he was always a house of cards. Still, in the beginning, their relationship was intoxicating and held the promise of a great love story. In the end, it was dog shit. Till death do us part. That's a man-made rule, too. An unreasonable one, she thinks. Everything begins and ends. Every day and night, every concerto, every relationship, every life. Everything ends eventually. She wishes she and Richard had ended better. The playlist in the coffee shop, which had been a steady stream of pop songs, Ed Sheeran and Rihanna and Taylor Swift, switches abruptly to Thelonious Monk.
Mom, listen. You used to play something like this when I was little. Remember?
Karina stares at Grace with her mouth open, shocked. Grace had to have been 3 or 4.
Yes, I can't believe you do.
What kind of music do you play now? Asks Matt.
Classical, mostly Chopin, Mozart, Bach.
Oh, nice.
How come you don't play this?
Asks Grace.
A million reasons. I don't know.
Grace looks up and away, at nothing in particular, and listens. The song is Round Midnight, a late-night loungy ballad that makes Karina feel as if she should have her hands around a gin and tonic instead of a pumpkin spice latte. She imagines the keys under her fingers as she plays along with her mind's ear. The motor plan unfolded like an old family recipe, still legible after so many years. She feels the notes vibrating in her heart, and she's swept up in an intense longing, approaching something close to sorrow, regret. She listens to Monk playing jazz, and her heart fills with regret. A smile enlivens Grace's face, and her eyes brighten.
I love it, don't you?
Karina's cheeks flush pink again. She nods.
I do.
Chapter 6. In the languid, not quite conscious moments before Richard opens his eyes, newly familiar black notes dance across crisp white sheets of paper behind his lids. He hears the sound of the notes as his mind sees them, ascending arpeggios that call him like a siren to his bench. He opens his eyes. A ribbon of bright white light slices through the midline of the drawn heavy drapes of his bedroom. Another day. He instructs the fingers of his left hand to place scales on the fitted white sheet, his morning ritual, his daily exam. He studies this symphony of simple movement, this sequential rapid lift and drop of each finger like a sewing machine needle, the machinery of tendons, knuckles, veins, and muscle, no less miraculous and essential to him than his beating heart. Satisfied, he gets up, pees, and walks into the kitchen to prepare breakfast, resisting the impatient pull of his Steinway for the moment. Sitting naked at the kitchen island counter, he sips hot coffee through a straw while vaguely studying his feet. He commands his toes to wiggle. They comply. Bending his neck and curling his upper torso down, he stretches his lips to meet a powdered donut in his hand. His left shoulder has started to lock, limiting the vertical mobility of his arm. He tries not to dwell on the advancing paralysis that this new symptom likely predicts. Maybe the disease will stop there, in his left shoulder. He could live with that. As he alternates between donut and coffee, he allows his thoughts to peer down the rabbit hole and imagines the impact if this disease doesn't stop there. He pans around the room, his field of view narrowed like a series of close-up shots in a horror movie. The cabinet knobs, most already out of reach. The coffee maker, the sink, the refrigerator door handle, the light switches, his phone, his computer, his piano. He'll have 2 paralyzed arms, no hands. He won't be able to feed himself, scratch his head, wipe his ass. He stares at his piano as he sucks up the last drops of coffee. Maybe the disease will stop in his shoulder. Finished with coffee and donut, he wants to lick clean the dusty white sugar covering his fingertips, but instead wipes it onto the bare skin of his thigh. He'll continue brewing coffee throughout the day, but only for the invigorating aroma it diffuses throughout his home. More than a cup gives him the shakes. Done with breakfast, he showers, bending over to shampoo his hair, in and out before the bathroom mirror fogs. He examines his furry face at the vanity. It's been almost 2 weeks since he last shaved. He can still adequately manage the job with his left hand, but he hasn't felt like bothering. Maybe he'll shave today. Although he's right-handed, a life at the piano has made him essentially ambidextrous. He feels so lucky. He smiles. But his smile in the mirror is dressed in a beard he doesn't want, and he thinks of all the people in the world with two healthy, functional hands and clean-shaven faces who don't have ALS, and his mind mocks him for feeling fortunate. His smile is a betrayal of his grim reality, a Pollyanna fool's mission. What do you have to smile about? Shamed, he stops. His closed-lipped face is somber, serious, covered in black hair, a bit menacing, a much more appropriate portrayal of a 45-year-old man with a fatal neuromuscular disease. He decides to keep the beard. He stands before his closet, demoralized by so many sleeves and buttons, and considers not dressing at all. But then he remembers what he's ready to play, and inspired, he goes in the completely opposite sartorial direction. He pulls out his best tuxedo. Socks and trousers are challenging, but doable. Lace-up shoes are history. He slides his feet into patent leather loafers. Now the top half. His eyes fill with sinking dread as he hopelessly puzzles over the pleated shirt, the waistcoat, the cufflinks, the bow tie. To hell with all that. He threads his tuxedo jacket sleeve over his lifeless right arm and buttons a single button over his bare-chested body with relative ease. There, ready to perform. Being mathematically minded, he'd assumed that playing the piano with one hand would be at most only half as satisfying as with two, but he was 100% wrong. For the past 3 days, he's been rapt and obsessed with Maurice Ravel's piano concerto for the left hand. It's about a 15-minute piece played alone, 18 with a whole orchestra, a single movement originally composed for Austrian pianist Paul Wittgenstein, who lost his right arm in World War I. Richard sits tall at his bench, places his right hand on his lap, and turns the sheet music over, hiding the notes. He'll play it this time from memory. He positions his left hand on the keys and waits. He imagines an audience of several hundred in his living room, the conductor and orchestra in his kitchen. The concerto begins immersed in darkness, a foreboding storm in the bass and tenor registers, the solemn contrabassoon, the thundering drums. Richard's solo begins about a minute and a half in. His hand climbs the scales, lifting everyone out of the sinister storm, evoking visions of shimmering sunlight. His left fingers have full command over all 88 keys, traversing from hell to heaven, the piece richly embodied with one hand. His concentration is fiercely devoted to every note, yet he isn't thinking. He's been practicing Ravel for 9 hours a day, and now the music is pulsing inside him. The memory of every sharp and rest and staccato encoded in the muscles of his hand, as well as his mind. He can't tell if his eyes are directing his fingers or following them, witnessing. He's reached that magical part of the curve where he's no longer playing the music. The music is playing him. He hears the whimsical cat-and-mouse game, the call-and-answer conversation between the music he's creating and his mind's rendition of the strings and horns. The song now ascends into hopeful possibility, each note an imagined marching drum beat reaching toward triumphant ecstasy. Closer and faster without rushing, a crescendo that vibrates and steadily rises in his body like the expectation of certain orgasm, he plays along with the imagined massive orchestra, louder, closer, higher, finally ending all at once like the dramatic climax of an epic film in heroic victory. And with that last resonating note, the victory is his. He looks to the darkened living room, the shade still drawn, adrenaline dancing through his heart as he receives the applause, the audience rising in a standing ovation. He turns to the kitchen to acknowledge the orchestra and thank the conductor. He stands and bows to the couch. In the stark silence of his apartment, the experience of Ravel's concerto exciting his soul, he imagines taking this performance to a real venue with a real orchestra. He could do this. He could tour this piece as a guest with symphonies the world over. Of course he could. His career isn't over. His agent is going to love this. He sits back at his bench, readying to play it again. He positions his left hand on the keys, but instead of hearing the orchestra begin in his mind's ear, he hears only the oppressive silence of his empty apartment, and a voice in his head, an arrogant naysayer stealing his confidence, talking him out of this pathetic plan. Richard lifts his left arm straight out in front of him. It begins to tremor just below shoulder height. He tries to will it higher, recruiting every muscle fiber he can conjure to the job, but his arm won't budge any farther. Exhausted, he lowers his hand back onto the piano keys. Instead of beginning his solo, in opposition to the overbearing silence and the voice in his head, he plays a single note, D, with his pinky. He holds the key and the foot pedal down, listening to the singular sound, bold and three-dimensional at first, then drifting, dispersing, fragile, decaying. He inhales. The smell of coffee lingers. He listens. The note is gone. Every note played is a life and death. Maybe the disease will stay in his shoulder. The voice in his head knows better and insists on another peek down the rabbit hole. No hands. Richard leaves the piano. He retreats to his bedroom, undresses, and crawls back into bed. He does not call his agent. He lies on his back, staring at the ceiling, wishing he could stop time, hiding from his future, knowing without any doubt or hope that someday soon he won't simply be peeking down that rabbit hole. He's going to live and die in there. Chapter 7. Alone in a cheerless examining room, Richard waits for Kathy DeVillo. It's the beginning of October, and this is the fourth time he's waited in a similarly impersonal room for her, the first instance almost a year ago. Kathy is the nurse practitioner overseeing his medical care at the ALS clinic. Care is the term they use here, and Richard doesn't openly object, but care is not what's provided every 3 months when he comes for his appointment. The staff all mean well. He has no doubt of this. Kathy is nice and clearly cares about her job and him, but as an ALS care coordinator, her pockets contain little more than tongue depressors. These clinic visits primarily amount to data collection, a chronicling of worsening symptoms indicative of disease progression. Every 3 months, the losses are noticeable, significant, and Kathy and others record these losses in various charts. Each clinic day is a Q&A series aimed at measuring what has gone from bad to worse. Kathy will offer some practical strategies for coping, some sympathetic nodding, and a preview of coming attractions. You think this is bad? Wait till you see what's next. His neurologist might adjust the dosage of Ryotec. He might not. It takes at least 3 hours to do all the measuring, and by the end of every clinic day, Richard's morale is battered and defeated. He swears he won't come back. What's the point? Given that he has only a limited number of hours left as an animated being on this planet, to squander any of them sitting still in this room with Kathy, or waiting for Kathy, as the case may be, feels like an egregious injustice, or at least utterly irresponsible. Yet he comes, he does as he's told, which surprises him, as passive obedience isn't at all consistent with his character. If he had to put his soon-to-be paralyzed left finger on it, he'd admit that he dutifully comes to each clinic appointment, because he still has hope. Maybe there will be a breakthrough, a new clinical trial drug, something to slow it down, a cure. It could happen. What were the odds that a boy raised to devote his time equally between football, tractors, and Bud Light in rural Live Free or Die New Hampshire would grow up to be a world-renowned concert pianist? Probably the same as some scientist discovering the cure for ALS. It could happen. So he waits for Kathy. She finally enters the room, pink-faced and out of breath, as if she'd just jogged over from another wing of the hospital. She's wearing tortoiseshell glasses, a black knit sweater unbuttoned over an untucked white blouse, pants that are too short for her, and flat shoes fit for running the halls of the hospital. Her look more librarian than nurse. She washes her hands while saying hello, then settles into the chair opposite Richard and reads his record of decline from 3 months ago. His new baseline, the treacherous edge from which he'll now cliff dive. She looks up at him and raises her eyebrows. Where's Maxine? No longer together. Oh, I'm so sorry. That's okay. With the exception of Maxine, Richard's relationships with women had about the same shelf life as a carton of milk. Most met him after a performance, at a VIP cocktail party or charity fundraiser, starstruck and fascinated. They fell hard and fast, looking past his wedding band when he was married. In the beginning, they also tolerated his moodiness and the time he committed to the piano instead of them. They saw his passion for the music of Brahms, Chopin, and Liszt, the love and devotion he was capable of, and assumed the skills were transferable. To everyone's disappointment, he's never been able to love a woman the way he loves the piano, not even Karina. So, invariably, the women became frustrated, lonely, and dissatisfied with their lot as second fiddle, third if they realized they were in line behind his wife. At first, they tried even harder. It never worked. He doesn't know why. Maybe human beings are capable of only so much passion. The pie has only so many pieces. For Richard, all but a sliver is devoted to piano. He loves women, appreciates them as much as any man, but ultimately they find themselves achingly hungry with him, and he refuses to feed them. His artistry for playing piano seduces them. His lack of artistry as a man is why they leave. Steeped in denial, he started seeing Maxine 2 months after he was diagnosed. She didn't notice that he couldn't lift his right arm above his elbow, or that he always positioned himself to her right so he could hold her hand with his left. He might have slurred his words a touch in the evening when his energy waned, but they'd just shared 2 bottles of wine. Then one morning she caught him weeping, his hands in his lap at the piano, and he confessed everything. Instead of running for the hills, she rolled up her sleeves. An acupuncturist, she was convinced she could save him, but no amount of needling, cupping, or burning moxa could prevent his right arm from steadily filling with concrete. She kept at it, but they both knew the effort had become insincere. Decency laced with guilt prevented her escape. The situation wasn't healthy for either of them. Sex became quick and unimaginative. She became afraid of his body. He became indifferent to hers. He focused on her imperfections. She wore too much eye makeup. She had bad breath. She wasn't beautiful enough, interesting enough, challenging enough. Her list of complaints was just as lengthy. For 4 months, they argued and sulked and danced silently around the real reason the relationship had to end. It took him that long to accumulate the courage he needed to break up with her. She didn't protest. They hugged for a long time. Then she walked out the door. It was the most unselfish act of his life. Anyone looking after you? No, I'm doing okay on my own. You're going to need help. Your parents, a relative, friends. You can hire private nurses, home health aides, but that will get expensive. Can you call on someone? Uh-huh. His mother died of cervical cancer when she was 45. Richard is 45, apparently a rough age in his lineage. He hasn't spoken to his father in years. His 2 brothers live in New Hampshire. They work full-time, and their wives are raising young kids. They aren't options. Grace is in school, and that's where she belongs. He still hasn't told her. He doesn't know how. He draws Karina's name next, but immediately returns that card to the deck. There's no way. How's your living situation? Did you find a new place? No, I'm still good where I am. Richard, you're on the 4th floor of a walk-up. Really, you have to get a new place ASAP before you need a wheelchair. You're going to need elevators, ramps, okay? He keeps his gaze steady, refusing any sign of agreement. He could still walk. How could he be in a wheelchair ASAP? He knows this is where the disease goes, yet he can't bring himself to fully imagine it. He looks into Kathy's big brown eyes. She can. Easy peasy. So, tell me what's going on. It's starting in my left arm. I can't raise my hand above my shoulder, and my fingers are a bit weaker. I can't lift anything heavy. I'm dropping things. Walking is still mostly okay.
Mostly?
Yeah. Okay, what about eating, drinking, talking? Mostly okay. Okay, we'll check out these mostlies to see what's happening. Let's start with your left hand. Spread your fingers and don't let me bunch them back together. He spreads his fingers like a starfish. She scrunches them together with 1 second's minimal effort. Hold your hand straight out in front of you and don't let me push it down. Resist me. She applies a bit of pressure and his arm collapses to his side. The last time he was here, he still had the use of both arms and could raise both hands when asked. But his right arm crumbled with the mere suggestion of force on Kathy's part, and he remembers the terror that rushed through him like a cold blue current, chilling his heart, realizing that he possessed almost no strength in that arm and that he was about to lose the use of it entirely and forever. He remembers thinking, at least I still have my left arm. He glances now at his left hand, defeated and shamed by his side, and he knows what this profoundly simple exercise will look like in 3 months' time. Make an A-OK sign with your thumb and index finger and lock them into a ring. Don't let me pull them apart. She pulls them apart. He wants to punch this nice lady in the face with his feeble hand. Show me a big smile, so big it's fake, like Hillary. He does. Now pucker, like Trump. He does. Open your mouth and don't let me shut it. He opens his mouth, and with the heel of her hand under his chin, she steadily closes his bottom jaw. Stick your tongue out and don't let me move it. She pushes down and right and left on his tongue with a popsicle stick, shifting it in each direction. Lick your lips all the way around. Her eyes track his tongue in a circle. Fill your cheeks with air and don't let me pop them. She does. Are you having any trouble blowing your nose? No. Any trouble with saliva? Like, am I drooling? Yeah. No. How about coughing? Any trouble clearing your throat? Not really. Let me see. Cough from deep down. Give me a big throat clear. He tries to take a deep breath, but hits a wall sooner than expected, and so his cough comes out shallow and sputtering. He's embarrassed. He was going for the cough of a lion, but instead, he's a kitten hacking up a hairball. Take a big breath and expel a note for as long as you can. Ready? Go. He chooses middle C and runs out of air at about 15 seconds. Is that normal? Kathy doesn't say. She goes to the sink and fills a plastic cup with water. Here, take a few sips and then chug the rest. He does while she appears to study something about his Adam's apple. Is taking your meds giving you any trouble? No. Good. Taking pills is the highest level of swallowing, so that's great. Water's the fastest liquid and will give you the most trouble. You drink coffee? Yeah. How do you take it? Black. Okay, you need to switch now to cream. Thicken all of your liquids. Make them slower. Thin liquids can lead to aspiration. How's your weight? She looks through the pages of his various charts. I've lost a few pounds. Eating has become a joyless, necessary chore. Anything that requires a knife and fork is out. Gone are medium-rare filet mignons at Grill 23. Opening jars and the packaging to his favorite cheese and the twist tie on a new loaf of bread requires a collaboration between his left hand and his knees and his teeth, and a patient persistence he often doesn't possess. Unable to lift his hand to even shoulder height at the end of the day, he has to lower his mouth to meet his fork or spoon. It's painstaking and sloppy, and he looks ridiculous, and because he can't get over worrying about what he looks like, he refuses to eat in public. Dining used to be a social and savored experience. Now he mostly orders takeout and eats alone. And he's started choking. The muscles that coordinate the safe movement of food from the back of his mouth down the esophagus to his stomach must be weakening because sometimes food gets lodged halfway down the tube, or worse, sucked down the wrong pipe. And as they just witnessed, he now has the coughing capacity of a kitty cat, so a small bite of cracker has been a life-threatening endeavor more than once. Almost killed by a cracker. He doesn't share this with Kathy. Okay, yep, you've lost 7 pounds in 3 months. We need to stabilize your weight. You need to eat more high-fat, high-density foods and liquids. Okay. Cream in your coffee, butter on your bread, pies a la mode. Everything my cardiologist recommends. We're not going to worry about heart disease.
Right. A heart attack would be a blessing.
Can you lift your right leg for me and don't let me push it down? He resists her for many sustained seconds through increasing pressure before he finally fails. They do the same exercise on the left until he fails. Good. You experiencing any foot drop, any falls? No. He's lying, and his heart beats faster as he waits to see if she catches him. He clipped his right toe on a step going up his front stoop last week, and he fell hard, bashing the right side of his chin and trampling his paralyzed forearm underneath his body. He's wearing a long-sleeve shirt, hiding the massive bruises covering his right arm, and his beard is apparently thick and dark enough to mask the scabbed gash on his chin. She taps his knees, checking his reflexes. She performs various strength tests on his feet. He gets a passing grade. Any cramping? No. Your legs are looking good for now, but your arm is going, so you won't be using a cane or a walker once your legs weaken. The power wheelchairs take 3 to 6 months to get, so we'll have PT put in an order for you now. Again, he stares at her with a flat gaze. She can go ahead and order the chair, but he won't endorse this decision with a blink or a nod. I'm worried about your dysphagia and the weight loss. Have you thought at all about whether you want to get a feeding tube? Only in that he doesn't want to think about it. No. Okay, Dr. Prince will talk you through what's involved and schedule you for the procedure if you decide to go ahead. He was scheduled to play in Chicago, Baltimore, Oslo, Copenhagen. He's supposed to schedule piano concerts, not feeding tube surgery. His head swims. Your breathing still seems strong. Dr. Kim's going to see you next to check you out more thoroughly there. Dr. Kim is the pulmonologist. Have you banked your voice yet? No. Is this something you want to do? I'm not sure. It might be a good idea to look into that now. When the time comes, you can always use the synthetic computer-generated voice, but it's really nice to have the option of still using your own. The guy who does the banking is at Children's Hospital. I'll make sure you have his contact information before you leave today. If you want to do it, I wouldn't put it off much longer. Kathy flips through his charts, pencils in some additional notes that Richard can't decipher, then looks up at him and smiles, satisfied. That's all for me. Do you have any questions? Anything you need that I can help you with? Let's see, what does he need? He needs to bank his voice because he'll soon be unable to speak, and the alternatives are to sound like Stephen Hawking or be totally mute. He might need a feeding tube. He's going to need a wheelchair ASAP. He needs a new apartment with an elevator and ramps. He needs someone to look after him. It's too much to take in, too many losses and needs at once. He tries to focus on what is most immediate, the loss of his left hand. He'll have no hands. He'll no longer be able to feed himself, dress himself, wash himself. He'll empty his bank accounts and hire help. He won't be able to type on the computer. He'll use his big toes. He's going to lose Ravel's piano concerto for the left hand. He'll never play the piano again. This is the loss he's imagined in microscopic detail from the first hints of this disease, the one that guts him through his center and keeps him from sleeping, and makes him want to swallow a bottle of pills and end his life now. Because without the piano, how can he live? Yet, this isn't the loss that has him suddenly stunned and panic-stricken, unable to swallow his own pooling saliva. He's thinking about Maxine again, and he's revisiting their goodbye hug. He can still feel her body in this remembered embrace, her breasts pressed against his chest, her wet cheek on his shoulder, her breath on his neck. He can feel the apology, the tragic love story, and the memory of that hug. He let go first. Maxine quickly followed his lead, slipped out of his arms, and left his life. He wishes now that he'd hung on a little longer. He's about to lose his left arm. 3 months ago, he hugged Maxine for the last time. Could that be the last embrace of his entire life? He swallows hard, but he chokes on his spit, and the coughing quickly turns to crying. Kathy offers him a tissue. Humiliated, he takes it, but then again he decides he doesn't care. What hasn't she already seen in this room? He sputters, coughs, cries, and drools through 3 more tissues, then collects himself just enough to find his voice. I need a hug. Kathy sets the tissue box aside without hesitating and stands in front of him. Richard rises to meet her, and she wraps him in a firm embrace. He's dousing her sweater with his tears and runny snot, and Kathy doesn't flinch. He hugs her with his left arm, pressing her into him, and she responds, hugging him back, and their contact creates a human connection that feels as vital to him as the air he can still breathe. He can't name the element at first. The connection isn't about hope. It doesn't contain sympathy. It's not made of love. It's care. Richard exhales and doesn't let go. Kathy stays with him. This is care.
Chapter 8. While her neighborhood still sleeps, Karina is standing on the sidewalk in front of her house, waiting for Elise. The cold air crowds her, penetrating her clothing, and she wishes Elise would materialize so Karina can get her blood moving. She hugs herself as she watches her exhales, white puffs that lift and disperse into the sky as if returning to the clouds. Realizing that she's standing beneath one of the towering oak trees lining her street, she shifts her position a few feet to the middle of the road. She tilts her face toward the sky, searching for warmth from the sun, but it hasn't risen yet. The door finally opens, and Elise emerges. "Sorry, I couldn't find my gloves." They fall in step and walk wordlessly through their tidy neighborhood of landscaped yards and two-car garages, still-darkened windows adorned with school-made ghosts and witches, front porches hosting impressively carved jack-o'-lanterns, pots of green and purple kale, and golden hardy mums. Without stopping, Karina plucks a Tootsie Roll wrapper from the street and pockets it. Karina and Elise won't break into conversation until they reach the reservoir. Anxious to get there, Karina walks a touch faster. Without questioning, Elise keeps up. They've been walking together one morning a week for 3 years. Although only recently neighbors, Karina and Elise met at a faculty dinner at the New England Conservatory of Music 20 years ago. Richard had just accepted a highly coveted teaching position in the piano department. They'd moved from New York City because of this prestigious job offer, from the jazz scene at Smalls and 55 Bar, the network of rising musicians Karina jammed with and loved, the steady gigs she played on weekends, and a promising footing in the career she dreamed of. She didn't realize this at the time, how one-sided the move would be when she agreed to it. She's often wondered how much Richard understood before they packed up and left. Not being from this country, she simply assumed Boston would have a significant jazz culture. Surely she would find other hip clubs, other talented artists, other opportunities for expression and hire. Boston loves the classical concerts of the Boston Symphony Orchestra and the Pops at Symphony Hall and the Esplanade. Bostonians are fanatically loyal to the rock and pop music of hometown bands such as Aerosmith, the Dropkick Murphys, and New Kids on the Block. Jazz in New York, New Orleans, Berlin, Paris, and even Chicago is considered a renegade and revered art. There is no jazz scene in Boston. The musicians who play at the handful of jazz clubs in town are one-night guests. They come and they go. They don't live and breathe here. Even before she'd unpacked their dinner plates, she realized this devastating truth and hated herself for being so naive, so easily duped, as if she'd been promised sushi at a Mexican restaurant and never even asked to see the menu. Elise was Karina's beacon of hope at that first faculty dinner. A bassist and professor of contemporary improvisation, Elise talked about ragtime and Wynton Marsalis and African jazz. She recorded an album with her students the previous year, a campus production, not exactly Blue Note, but still exciting. Karina couldn't wait to connect with her again, to ask her about playing somewhere, anywhere, maybe auditing one of her classes, possibly even teaching. But Elise was missing from the next faculty dinner. She'd been diagnosed with an aggressive form of breast cancer, and had taken a leave of absence to undergo treatment. Then Karina became unexpectedly pregnant with Grace, and Richard left New England Conservatory for what became an endless year of touring, so there were no more faculty dinners. Over time, Karina forgot about Elise. She retreated into the intensity, responsibility, and loneliness of full-time motherhood, resigning herself to living in Richard's immense shadow, darker, lonelier, and far more inescapable than the pre-dawn sky of a grim November morning. While she never planned on being a mother, she loved Grace fiercely from the moment she was born, and couldn't imagine choosing the kind of life Richard was living, gone for weeks at a time, devoting his days and weeks and years so singularly to his career. Even when he was home, he'd practice for 8 to 10 hours a day. He was there, but not there. She couldn't bear the thought of being separated from Grace, of missing any milestone. She wanted to witness her daughter discovering the world, the magic of seeing her first rainbow, the feel of a dog's fur and tongue, the silky sweet taste of vanilla ice cream. Karina wanted to be the person Grace saw when she awoke from her naps, who hugged her when she cried, who kissed her 100 times a day. She couldn't abandon this enormous, precious love, this gift. She loved Grace more than piano. And if she chose Grace over piano because she loved her daughter more, then Richard must not have loved Grace at all. This is the script she wrote and read to herself for years. He must be some kind of selfish monster to not love his own daughter, and she hated him for it. She built this case against him, black and white and indefensible. But now, looking back, she admits to herself that her conclusion was too extreme and not necessarily true. Love isn't measured by the number of hours a person logs. For the first time, she wonders if his affair started before or after she began hating him. At some point, she can't locate exactly when, she abandoned any possibility of a career in jazz piano. The goal became too implausible, childish, foolish. She thinks about it now as she walks, the vague dream of that intended life she never lived, and it feels like a comet she'd once seen long ago, blazing across the night sky, witnessed for the briefest, breathtaking moment, and then gone for another 100 years. While Karina was raising Grace and resenting Richard, Elise beat breast cancer, joined the faculty at Berklee College of Music, divorced her husband, and started dating her radiologist. They married and 4 years ago moved from Boston to the suburbs, directly across the street from Karina. Kindred spirits reunited. Karina still marvels at this serendipity, and her Catholic mind can't help but wonder if God led Elise here for a reason. As they walk past Oak Hill Cemetery, the date returns to Karina's consciousness. Today is November 1st, All Saints' Day, a national holiday in Poland. As a child, she would spend the entire day at the cemetery with her family. Everyone did this. Having lived in the United States her entire adult life, this tradition now seems a bit morbid and creepy, even in comparison to Halloween. But she always liked it. She remembers the white votive candles placed on the raised gravestones, dots of light sprinkled around her as far as she could see like stars spread across the universe. She remembers her family gathered, her parents, aunts, uncles, and cousins telling stories of those who'd passed away. She savored the stability she felt, listening to those stories, and being connected to that history, a single bead strung on an infinitely long, uniquely beautiful necklace. She loved hearing how her grandparents on both sides met, courted, married, had children. She remembers studying their names etched on the gravestones, imagining the lives she barely and never knew, and that double-edged feeling of importance and insignificance, a fate and random chance this still generates, that every moment of those four lives had to unfold exactly as it did, or she wouldn't be here. They reach the dirt path along the reservoir and begin the three-mile loop. Here they'll begin chatting, as if they're finally out of earshot of their neighbors, their words safe among the trees, the Canada geese in the water, an occasional jogger, dog, and dog walker. How was school this week? This is always Karina's first question, inviting the conversation that both inspires and tortures her, like a recovering addict asking for a sip of wine. Good. I'm loving that new student I told you about, Claire. She's got such a great ear, and she's so totally open to listening and failing. You've got to come hear her play. There's a class show in 2 weeks. Okay. And we're planning the student trip to New Orleans. You should come this year. Maybe. Karina won't go to either. Elise invites her to all kinds of shows and classes and guest lectures, and every year to the New Orleans trip, and Karina declines it all. Her excuse used to be grace. She couldn't go because Richard was out of town and she was needed at home. Now that she's divorced and her excuse is at the University of Chicago, she has to come up with some other reason. She'll be too tired the evening of the class show. And maybe she'll plan a visit to see Grace the same week Elise and her students are in New Orleans. The thought of being immersed in the jazz scene in New Orleans, that magical hodgepodge of Delta blues guitar riffs, brassy ragtime horns, and sultry French gypsy music, is too painful for Karina to stomach. Every girl loves a wedding, unless the groom is the lost love of her life. And maybe one of these days you'll come play with us, please. Someday. Elise plays bass in a contemporary improvisation band called the Dishpans, with faculty from Berklee, New England Conservatory, and Longy, mostly in bohemian restaurants and hipster bars that have a rotating roster of live music. Someday is always Karina's reply, and she'd like to believe that it's true. While she plays and teaches piano almost every day, she's restricted herself to the classical music of Chopin, Beethoven, Schumann, Mozart. The dots are already on the page, and she plays them with the obsequious reverence of a Catholic priest reading from the Bible or an actor quoting Shakespeare. Jazz improvisation is a speech without a script. It's 12 notes and doing anything she pleases. There are no rules, no boundaries. Verbs don't have to follow nouns. There's no gravity. Can be down. And it's collaborative. She hasn't played jazz with anyone since before Grace was born. It shatters her heart every time she realizes how many years it's been. She could remedy this by taking Elise up on her offer. What if someday was today? Her breath goes shallow, and the wind off the reservoir chills the sweat on her forehead. She's too out of practice. It's been too long. A runner laid up for years with an Achilles injury can't simply show up at the Olympic trials. Karina imagines playing with such practiced and accomplished musicians, and the fear of her certain and overwhelming inadequacy locks her life's greatest wish in a box. "So I need to come clean," says Elise. "I visited Richard." Karina stops walking, every muscle's action suspended. Stuck in stunned betrayal. Elise pauses several steps ahead and turns around. Roz from the conservatory called. It was nice of her to remember me. She organized a bunch of the staff who knew him from his teaching days, and we all went over. I felt like it was the decent thing to do. Begrudgingly satisfied with this explanation and fueled by curiosity, Karina starts up again. The two women walk side by side. "So, how is he?" Karina asks, a reluctant toe edging into muddy water. "His arms are completely paralyzed. That was upsetting to actually see." The previously dormant pit in Karina's stomach, planted months ago, sprouts roots. This is really happening. Aside from not being able to open the bottle of wine, he'd looked and acted perfectly normal when she last saw him in July. She'd been holding on to the possibility that his diagnosis was a rumor or a mistake. She still hates him, but palpably less than she did last year, and hasn't wished him dead since before the divorce. She wouldn't wish ALS on anyone, not even Richard. She kept waiting to see a correction in the newspaper, his tour back on, that the reports of his imminent death had been greatly exaggerated. I'd planned on giving him the stink eye for you, but his arms were just hanging off his body like dead branches. And there was his piano in the room with all of us trying to pretend it wasn't there. None of us mentioned it. It was too sad. Richard was at the piano. A fish without water. A planet without a sun. How did he seem about it? His spirits were good. He was happy to see us all, but you could tell he was trying really hard to be positive, like he was performing. They continue walking in silence, and soon the silence fills the sound, the muffled steps of their sneakers on the dirt path, softened by a bed of brown pine needles, and then the crunching of dry, brown paper bag oak leaves. Elise sniffling, the huffing of their exhales. "Does Grace know?" asks Elise. "Not unless someone else told her. I would know if she knew. No, honestly, I wasn't even 100% sure he had it until this very conversation." "Grace, she's in the middle of midterms. It would be cruel to break this news to her right now. She might get distracted and fail her exams. And why hasn't Richard told her?" "Of course he hasn't told her." "Maybe I should go see him again," says Karina. "That's your Catholic guilt talking." "No. Remember what happened last time?" "I know. Seeing him is not good for you." Richard had always seemed invincible to Karina, as if he could conquer anything, and he did. He was an unstoppable force that awed and intimidated her, and at times when she was most vulnerable, trampled her. Now he's the vulnerable one, and she can't help but wonder what it would feel like to sit at the other end of the table. "Yeah, but what are you hoping for? Tuesdays with Maury?" "I don't know. He's still Richard, honey. Believe me, I know who he is. Just don't get hurt." "I won't," Karina says, her voice utterly void of conviction. Chapter 9. Karina is carrying a foil-covered plate of pierogi in one hand, a $50 bottle of red wine in the other, and several months of unrelenting guilt down Commonwealth Avenue. It's a gunmetal gray November morning, raining hard, and she has no hands for an umbrella, and four more blocks. She picks up her pace, almost running, and the wind whips the hood off her head. Damn it. She has no available hand to pull it back on. The weather hits her like an assault, and since she's the only pedestrian in sight, the attack feels personal. Raindrops pummel the aluminum foil like machine gun fire. The bitter cold wind stings her face raw. Rain soaks through her socks, pants, and hair, chilling her skin like a punishment. She blames Richard. She wouldn't be subjected to this misery if he hadn't provoked her. Of course she reacted, just as she always did. It's as if she were programmed to respond to him, an unthinking and immediate ouch to his pinch. It was already raining when she left the safety of her house, and she knew she wouldn't likely find a parking space within four blocks. She could have waited another day. Tomorrow's weather forecast is cold but clear. But she made the pierogi last night, and she needs to make at least this one thing between Richard and her right. Clean up her side of the street, deliver her penance, and be done. Carpe diem, weather be damned. Focused on the numbers on the door and the promise of shelter, she barely registers the for sale sign planted in the minuscule square patch of front lawn as she races past it. Out of breath and shoulders hugging her ears at the top of the stairs, she presses the doorbell and waits. Her hands, wet and lacking circulation and painfully cold, are aching to let go of her peace offerings and find comfort inside her coat pockets. Without a greeting or question as to who's there, she's buzzed inside. When she reaches Richard's unit, the door is ajar. She knocks as she edges the door open a bit more to be heard. "Hello? Come on in," a man's voice, not Richard's, hollers from somewhere inside. "We'll be done in a minute." Karina enters, steps out of her shoes at the door, and returns to the kitchen, the scene of the crime. The lights are on. The room smells of coffee. The kitchen island and counters are wiped clean and are bare, but for three glasses filled to the top with what looks to be vanilla milkshake, a tall straw standing erect in each. There's no noise, no sign of anyone. She sets the wine and pierogi down on the counter, removes her raincoat, and drapes it over one of the bar stools. She waits, not knowing whether to sit or stand, growing increasingly uneasy. Maybe she should find a piece of paper and pen, write a note, and leave. Her attention wanders to the living room and screeches to a sudden stop, stunned. A wheelchair. A wheelchair unlike any other she's ever seen. The tipped headrest and seat resemble a dentist's chair. The two strapped footrests remind her of the stirrups on a gynecologist's exam table. There are six wheels and shock absorbers and a joystick affixed to one of the arms. This is not a chair for a broken leg. It looks futuristic and barbaric. Cold rainwater drains from her hairline, trickling down her neck. She shivers. The chair is positioned next to Richard's piano. She looks again, and the piano is as unfamiliar and formidable as the wheelchair. An inner chill, more penetrating than the rain on her skin, drips down her spine. The key cover is shut. The music rack is bare. The bench is pushed in. She approaches Richard Steinway as if she were trespassing on sacred ground, her mind still disbelieving the incongruity of the sight before her. She hesitates, gathering courage, then slides her index finger along its lid, clearing a thick layer of fine dust, revealing a snail trail of the piano's glossy black finish.
"Hi."
She spins around, heart pounding, as if she were a criminal caught in an illicit act. Richard is standing behind a bald man with black-rimmed glasses.
"I'm Bill."
He wields an energetic wide smile, extending his hand to hers.
"Richard's home health aid."
"Karina." She shakes his hand.
"Okay, well, that's it for me. Gotta run," Bill says. "Melanie will be here for lunch, Rob or Kevin for dinner and bed. You got three shakes in the kitchen. Y'all good?"
Richard nods. Bill checks something on Richard's iPhone, worn on his chest and attached to a lanyard hung around his neck like a conference badge.
"Okay, my friend. Call us if you need us. See you in the morning."
Richard stares at Karina as Bill leaves and says nothing. His hair's wet, combed, and parted too severely and neatly to the side. He looks like a young boy on school picture day. He's clean-shaven, his face gaunt. His black sweater and jeans hang on him, long and baggy, as if they belonged to a big brother or were borrowed from Bill. Unsettled by the wheelchair, the abandoned piano, Richard's emaciated appearance, and prolonged silence, Karina forgets why she's here and begins to wonder if he can speak at all. He notices her apology on the counter. "Pierogi," she says. "I'm sure the wine is below your standards, but it's the thought that counts."
"Thank you."
He walks into the kitchen, and that's when she notices. His arms don't swing. They sag from his shoulders, still, lifeless.
and Bo's hands look wrong, inhuman. The fingers of his right hand are stick-straight, flattened. The other hand is fixed in a grotesquely curled claw. He positions himself in front of one of the milkshakes, lowers his head to the straw,